This is the lecture for week 10. The topic is new genres of collaborative creativity and the economics of online sharing. The themes for the lecture today are about, we're going to cover a lot of territory, but copyright in the digital age will be the chief focus, and how what was once a backwater in intellectual property law became a rather central element of political and social struggle. We'll talk about the discovery of the public domain, the invention of the Creative Commons licenses, and how this gave rise to all sorts of collaborative creative sectors that relied upon the licenses to create shareable pools of content. And we'll talk about some of the new theoretical ideas to show how commons-based peer production, in Professor Yochai Benkler's term, can be highly generative, can create value in ways that the market can't or that are too expensive for markets. Essentially, the rise of the commons as a competitive vehicle for creating value in ways different and in some ways more powerful than the market. And we'll end up with a brief discussion of open business models. Now, this is, of course, a vast amount of territory we're covering, so we won't be able to go into too much depth. We'll leave a lot of that to the readings, which you can get deeper into it all. But let's start with copyright law. Copyright law was intended as a policy balance in which authors got monopoly rights as an incentive to get them to produce new works. But there were limits on that for the benefit of the public. It was a bargain. So the public, in return for giving these monopoly rights to authors, got fair use rights, which gave them the entitlement to use copyrighted works for non-commercial, personal, and scholarly purposes. Things like scholarship and journalism and commentary and parody all rely upon fair use to be legal. And they use copyright law without permission or payment. It's a point that to show that copyright law is not an absolute type of property right. Copyright also is limited in the length of time that an author has protection. When the copyright was first instituted at the beginning of the U.S. Republic, it was for 14 years, and later it was renewable for another 14 years, 28 years total. Over the decades, the length of copyright term has gotten so extended that currently it's the life of an author plus 70 years. So this little podcast will be locked up under copyright until, say, the year 2100, because that's ostensibly the amount of incentive that I need to create this, to have that kind of monopoly right. Well, of course, that's ridiculous, but that's the one-size-fits-all and overly extensive rule of copyright law. Another limitation on copyright law is the so-called first sale doctrine, and this is a legal right that allows the purchaser of, say, a book or a DVD to resell it or lend them, as libraries can lend books, without having to pay a royalty or get permission from the copyright holder. So, as you can see, it's a copyright is a policy balance, not an absolute property right. Now, the big problem in the past several decades has been the just grotesque expansion of the scope and term of copyright law, essentially to suit various industry needs or demands, and then the shrinkage of fair use rights and the public domain, so that the policy balance has gotten grossly imbalanced. Now, it's notoriously difficult to strike a fair and stable balance between the rights of the authors and the needs of the public, primarily because the industry, having acquired the author's rights, has the superior political power in Congress and the ability to assert those rights in the courts as well. And authors are more often than not the pawns of the publishers, just as the musicians are the pawns of the record labels. Yes, there are a handful of superstars who can bargain from a position of strength, But most creative types, be they musicians, authors, photographers, visual artists of other sorts, have been subservient to the middlemen, the publishers, the studios, the record labels, and they've had to sell their copyrights in order to reach audiences. So really, copyright has been more of a functional need for publisher than for authors in many cases, particularly since the arrival of the internet, which has allowed alternative means of distribution. And this is precisely why copyright shifted from being a very arcane, obscure policy issue that only industry lawyers argued about and was chiefly a matter of inter-industry disputes, into something that concerned the general public. And that's chiefly because the public started to become a creator in its own right and started to see that it had an interest in the shape of copyright law. Thanks to the growth of personal computers, all sorts of digital technologies, and the internet, people simply weren't passive consumers of copyrighted works. They were creators of them themselves. And so they needed to be able to have greater freedoms than copyright law is traditionally developed and enforced allowed them. So this is what sparked what I call the discovery of the public domain. Historically, the public domain had been regarded as a wasteland, a place where ancient government documents and archaic cultural works from the 1920s and 30s went to die. But as this material went online to the web, people started to discover it, and started to discover that they needed the public domain, and this set up a structural political war between copyright industries and the public that needs access to the public domain and to non-propertized work. Now, unfortunately, in the 1990s, the various copyright industries mobilized themselves to lobby Congress to push through a number of expansions of intellectual property law, especially copyright. Most notably, there was the Copyright Term Extension Act, which Disney was chiefly responsible for, which retroactively extended the term of copyright law by 20 years for works that had been created in the 1920s and 30s. And the chief reason for this was that Mickey Mouse was due to enter the public domain in 2003, and Disney wanted to prevent that. In the process of extending the terms of copyright law, tens of thousands of cultural works were locked up for another 20 years, a massive giveaway for no purpose. Copyright law, if it's meant to incentivize authors to create works, was not going to do that in this case, because you don't incentivize Robert Frost, George Gershwin, Walt Disney, and hundreds of other dead authors to create more works. It's simply a giveaway to their estates and the corporate holders of those copyrights. Then there was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was passed in 1998 and essentially eradicated the fair use rights of people in digital artifacts, as well as made it much more difficult to reverse engineer software. Industry also instituted all sorts of digital rights management schemes, usually called by critics the digital restrictions management, which put all sorts of works in an envelope of a technological lock so that it couldn't be used even for fair use purposes. And companies often applied one-sided restrictive contracts to software and digital works through either so-called shrink wrap licenses or on the web click-through licenses, where you had to agree to the license in order to have access to the work. A very one-sided deal that essentially wiped out the public side of the copyright bargain. And then there were extensions of trademark law, where a trademark could no longer be diluted, so-called, or tarnished without constituting an infringement. And many, many other such examples. This was the so-called copyright maximalist agenda. The idea is to push the rights of copyright holders as far as they could possibly go. Combined with this, the courts started to check in with a number of decisions that limited fair use rights. one of the more notable cases was the Nation magazine versus or Gerald Ford versus Nation magazine, where the Nation had obtained a copy of Ford's memoirs before they had been published and published a 600 words from the memoirs, which was hundreds of thousands of words. And that was regarded as an illicit use, not protected by fair use. The problem with fair use, of course, is that there are so many vague aspects to it and so many contradictory aspects to it, even in the court jurisprudence, that it's nearly impossible to make predictions of whether your work is protected by fair use or not. So it's a terrible way for people to have to be able to confidently use a copyrighted work and know that they won't be sued. So it was in this context that Professor Larry Lessig, Lawrence Lessig, of Harvard University and later of Stanford, and now he's back at Harvard, wanted to find a way to make the sharing of digital works, and other works too, legal. He wanted to see how the law might be altered, and his first vehicle for doing this was a constitutional test case. He wanted to test whether the constitutional provision that copyright must be for a limited term could turn back the Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998, which gave Disney those extra 20 years. And he found that there was a amateur website owner, Eric Eldred, who had a public web archive of public domain books of American literature. And it was such a popular site that it had tens of thousands of visitors every month, and the National Endowment for the Humanities gave him an award because it was showcasing the best of American culture. But then the Copyright Term Extension Act was passed, which made his website more problematic because books that had been published since 1923 could not be put on his website. And he found this outrageous and wanted to challenge it. Well, Larry Lessig had found his everyman as the plaintiff in this test case and began efforts to start the case. Now, waging a constitutional test case was unprecedented and unlikely to succeed. It had never been, this provision of the Constitution had never been challenged before, or cases based on it had not been brought before the court. But improbably, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear the case after the case had gone through the federal court and the Circuit Court of Appeals. And by February 2002, the case was before the court with oral arguments for that fall. Lessig based his case on an argument of originalist jurisprudence, meaning he thought that the Constitution's original plain language and the interpretation by the standards of that time would make his case almost a slam dunk, because he would argue, Lessig wanted to argue that those original purposes and values of the Constitution would be upheld by the originalist court justices like Justice Scalia and Thomas, among others. And Lessig thought that he had no chance of prevailing unless he appealed to the conservative justices. However, his line of argument was not only not accepted, it was virtually ignored by the court, and Eric Eldred, as argued by Larry Lessig, lost the case 7-2. The basic conclusion was that Congress might be stupid, but it's not the court's duty to strike down stupid laws, and that the long copyright terms, even if they were much greater than they were at the founding of the Republic, were not unconstitutional. The court exaggerated the actual utility of fair use law in the digital age, but it was able to cite it as how the public was protected. And it didn't even engage Lessig's originalist arguments. Now, this loss was a very big loss, but it had several important benefits, too. One, it clarified the terms of legal engagement on copyright law and fair use, essentially by showing that fair use was a dead letter or mostly so, that it would not be a useful vehicle for broad transformations of copyright law. Two, it showed that a litigation strategy was also likely to have limited results, and that any transformation in copyright law would have to come through political struggle and cultural struggle. And finally, it galvanized Lessig to initiate a new effort to develop what would become the Creative Commons licenses. So let's talk about the invention of the licenses briefly, which is discussed in Chapter 3 of my book, Viral Spiral. In inventing the CC licenses, Lessig realized that it would be impossible to build a movement for reform on the basis of fair use. As I mentioned, fair use was just too vague and unpredictable, and it was too locked into the property discourse of copyright law. And this was made worse by the arrival of the renegade software program Napster, which was released in June 1999, before the courts shut it down in July 2001. And this software, which allowed all sorts of copyrighted music to be shared freely with no payments to any of the copyright holders, polarized the whole fair use debate and the copyright reform debate, because it cast anyone who wanted to share digital objects as a pirate and strengthened the property rights arguments of the motion picture industry and the recording industry, among other industries. And this was precisely at the time when Lessig wanted to develop a new language, if not new legal protections, for a middle ground, a sharing of works between a place that stood between piracy and absolute property rights. So the challenge was how to legalize sharing and the reuse of works, how to argue that sharing might be necessary, desirable, and legal. Ultimately, he was inspired by the general public license for free software and how it ingeniously turned copyright law on its head and allowed the sharing of code to develop free and later open source software. Lessig convened a group of law scholars, computer tech experts, artists, and another variety of irregulars to see what they might develop, how a corresponding license for sharing of content might be developed. And their first idea was to develop a land trust for the public domain. That was their metaphor. A space online where people could donate works, songs or whatever, or where public domain works could be held, and you could have a repository of free and shareable works. And one formulation for this was to develop an IP conservancy, an intellectual property conservancy. And another formulation was, how do we brand the public domain? Well, there was a great deal of discussion and debate among selected scholars over a period of months about how the license scheme might be devised. And the big breakthrough came when Lessig and a handful of others realized that the internet in 2001, 2002, when these discussions were taking place, was a network, and it was very different in its dynamics from the more static print world. And the internet was a platform for networking, not just a place for static content like email and listservs. So Lessig realized that a system of licenses that could be tagged to works and follow them wherever they went on the internet might be more effective than having a more static place in a spatial sense, where, like an IP trust, where works would be held. So the idea became to leverage the powers of the network by using licenses that would be tagged with content. And then the viral propensities of the internet would be leveraged for great benefit. This was inspired in part by the rise of some of the earliest viral artifacts. There was cartoons and jokes and gags that suddenly were just taking off and being passed around. And this was a relatively new phenomenon, not as common as it is now. And law professor Michael Carroll noted this in particular, that this is a dynamic that needs to be used in devising the licenses. So the licenses they ultimately came up with were going to try to do what the GPL did. They were going to be based on copyright law and be used by copyright owners, but it would be trying to reverse the presumption of copyright law, which had held since the 1976 Copyright Act, that everything was born copyrighted upon creation. They wanted to build a non-proprietary culture of shareable content using the licenses. But there are many questions about how to structure the license. What sorts of permissions should be allowed? Should there be time limits on the licenses? Should there be substantive limitations on the speech for which the licenses were given? So could you say, for example, I won't allow my work to be reused by someone for hate speech purposes or by conservatives and so forth? Well, ultimately, they rejected all of those and developed a scheme of six basic licenses where there would be an attribution license where credit would have to be given to the author. There would be non-commercial licenses where you could use it for whatever purpose, but not for commercial purposes. A no-derivatives license that would prohibit any alteration of the work, say a photo or a piece of music. A share-alike license, which resembles the GPL, in that it would require allow anybody to use the work, but require them to make it shareable by anyone under the same terms as the share-alike license. And then there were combinations of the two, so you could combine the non-commercial license with the share-alike, the non-commercial with the no-derivatives license. These were the basic structures for sharing, which in different creative sectors would have different applications. So, for example, with music, there might be a propensity for the non-commercial license, whereas in photography or certain visual arts, perhaps no-derivatives, because they didn't want people splicing up the works. For a time, there were a number of other licenses that were invented, which I won't go into at length here, but they were later rescinded. One was a developing nations license, which allowed developing nations to use copyrighted works under the license for free. But a number of people, including Richard Stallman, objected that those works were not truly free because they were selecting certain beneficiaries, developing countries, and excluding others. He found that objectionable. There was a music sampling license, which similar objections were raised to, that it wasn't entirely free to use for any purposes. There were restrictions on it. And then there were other copyright-like, Creative Commons-like licenses, such as a public domain dedication, which, amazingly, the U.S. copyright statutes have no provisions for committing something to the public domain. So this was the creation of the legal infrastructure for sharing, a very important beachhead in the evolution of the sharing culture and the sharing economy. The first users of the Creative Commons licenses tended to be tech sophisticates, avant-garde artists, bloggers, activists, the rebellious of spirit. And they were used less for a functional need, even though, of course, they did legally protect you and allow sharing, than they were to signal a cultural identity. Namely, I believe in the sharing culture and object to the culture of mass media, which is often homogenized and standardized and not very good. So CC license users were saluting culture that was more eccentric and homegrown and authentic culturally. One of the first the first author, was Cory Doctorow, the editor, co-editor of Boing Boing, a popular website. He was a budding science fiction writer at the time and had written his first book, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. He released the novel under a Creative Commons license, an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license, in 2003. And he credits that license with helping to make him a best-selling author, because within 3 years, his book had been downloaded more than 700,000 times for free. But it had also gone through seven printings for sale, commercial sale, many foreign translations and two competing audio translations or adaptations made by fans. So essentially the licenses gave him enormous visibility without forcing him to forfeit his copyright prerogatives or the ability to make money through a conventional publisher, Tor Books. Now, there's many other examples in publishing, but the licenses have been far more popular on the web and for music, video, and photography. You could tell that the CC licenses had hit the mainstream and were really going to be around for a while when the band Nine Inch Nails released its album Ghosts 1 through 4 under a Creative Commons share-alike license in 2008. The band posted audio files of the album on its official website and invited free downloads. And they didn't do any advertising or promotion, but they still sold 2,500 copies of a so-called Ultra Deluxe Limited Edition for $300, which sold out in 3 days. And it sold a mere Deluxe Edition for $75 apiece, and then ordinary CDs for $10. And within a week, the band had made over $1.6 million from over 750,000 purchases. And there was no record label taking any middleman slice of this revenue. Normally, a band only gets about $1.60 per CD from a record label. In this case, you say the $10 sale, the band got all of it. So this was evidence that commercial acts could bypass the middlemen of record labels using the internet and using the CC licenses to help spread the word and let people share it. So it proved the counterintuitive notion that allowing the free sharing of a work could actually enhance its commercial sales. As of 2009, the creative licenses were estimated to be on more than 150 million web objects. That was music, video, blogs, academic articles, and much else. And then there were a number of major commercial websites, Google, Yahoo, Flickr, the photo sharing site, that allowed for the explicit search for CC licensed works on their sites. So, for example, Flickr now has more than 70 million photos on its site that can be reused under the Creative Commons licenses. One of the biggest users of the Creative Commons licenses are academics, who don't usually publish to make money anyway. Their journal articles and books rarely make much money. They make their money through their salaries as professors. So it made sense for them to use the licenses. They could use a simple attribution license because their primary concern is to reach a wide audience and build their reputation, not to make money. And that's what the licenses allow them to do. So over the past 8 years, there's been a whole growth of open access scholarly publishing, which uses Creative Commons licenses, usually just the attribution license, to publish. And the point is to, instead of having works locked behind a paywall for which you have to pay a subscription, and therefore they reach only a small audience, works can be published for free on open access journals or on institutional repositories and be free to anyone in perpetuity. This is a major advance in the spread of knowledge, a major rediscovery of academia as a commons. There is now nearly 5,000 open access journals that are publishing, and they include several ones. Several of these are associated with the Public Library of Science, which has been something of a pace setter for open access journals. And then it's also important to note that there are a number of for-profit open access publishers. Money can be made through publishing open access journals. And all of this has been helped by the National Institutes of Health, which has instituted a policy that requires all NIH-funded research, which is on the order of $30 billion a year, be made available 1 year after its publication in commercial journals. So this is a huge benefit for the public because the public is paying for this research as taxpayers, all sorts of medical and drug-related research. So why shouldn't taxpayers have free access to what they've financed themselves? This policy goes a long way towards doing it. It's not perfect because it still requires a year's embargo before it's available for free, but it's still quite good. Needless to say, the commercial journal publishers like Elsevier, Springer, Wiley, and others haven't been thrilled at the rise of open access journals because it threatens to undercut their lucrative franchise. But this is about time, because subscription rates for highly specialized academic journals have risen astronomically. Over the past 20 years, an average of 7.5% a year. And this has been a huge squeeze on the budgets of university libraries, and it's limited the access to it to academic knowledge, even within a specialty. So it's about time that open access developed a challenge. The strange anomaly that publishers, even though they're the last in the production chain that includes many others, the authors, the academic disciplines, the universities themselves, the peer review panels, that the publishers should own the copyright in this long production process. It's really quite gratuitous when there are other available means that are far more efficient, if not free, and are not don't come with the copyright restrictions or the digital restrictions management that commercial journals tend to have. Another, there's been a whole cluster of innovations that the Creative Commons licenses have allowed in education. There's something now called the Open Educational Resources, or OER, movement. And the basic idea is to use the tools of free software and the Creative Commons licenses, and then the relevant social communities within education, to reinvent learning and education. And the way you do this is to create pools of either tools like software or websites, or pools of content, specialized content, that the community develops and maintains and protects for itself. And the idea is to make information and learning more accessible, affordable, and exciting. One of the earliest initiatives in this regard was MIT's OpenCourseWare initiative, which in 2001, instead of trying to sell its knowledge on in the distance learning market that was then emerging, MIT realized that it was never going to be that big of a market or very lucrative of a market. And furthermore, the university's public values are to promote the widest dissemination and sharing of its discoveries. And so it didn't want to impose a property regime to restrict knowledge. It wanted to open the floodgates and leverage the power of networks. So it started to put its entire curriculum of all 2,000 of its courses online for free for anyone to use. So this would include the syllabus, the lecture notes, the class assignments, the problem sets, the simulations and exams and video lectures when they're available. And this was very counterintuitive, and many people thought they were crazy for putting their works online for free. But in the intervening years, the OpenCourseWare has become a flourishing new genre, one might say, of education. There are more than 140 institutions internationally that have published their own OpenCourseWare curricula, putting them online. MIT's curricula has had a major impact on Chinese education and in other developing countries, as those countries see how physics, for example, is taught at MIT. And the MIT brand name, so to speak, has become far more visible and prominent as a result of its MIT's curricula being put online. Now, that's sort of static content, the OpenCourseWare. An example of dynamic, more collaborative content is the Rice University's Connections Project. Connections spelled with an X, C-O-N-N-E-X-I-O-N-S. And this is a major international repository of teaching materials that teachers and students themselves contribute and put on the website. and they create learning modules. And there are literally thousands, I think at last count, more than 6,000 or 7,000 learning modules woven into 350 or more collections. And it can be on anything from electrical engineering or music theory or chemistry or bioinformatics or biology or history, a huge number of different topics where you have communities of scholars and teachers creating content, modifying it as needed, and then using it to teach in all sorts of different contexts. All of it's free, all of it's freely modifiable, and it all uses the Creative Commons licenses to allow that sharing. So this is just kind of an example of the types, the innovative types of collaborative innovation going on in education. You have open textbook projects that are trying to create free, modifiable textbooks as a way to undercut the soaring prices of textbooks, where they come out with a new edition every year or two so that students have to buy the new one and can't buy a used copy. You have all sorts of collaborative tools like a big telescope in Hawaii that students can connect to via the internet and use. You have a whole genre of innovations that the Science Commons, a spin-off of Creative Commons, is helping to catalyze. So for example, let me just step back for a second. Scientific knowledge is more structured, and it's not as if you can just do a Google search to find the terms you want, and that's helpful. I mean, a Google search for the word peridium, which is a very specialized kind of substance, turns up some 400,000 results, which is far too many to sort through and use intelligently. And every day there is so much new scientific literature generated that it would take a single person 106 years to read it all, by one estimate. So with scientific knowledge being structured in very special ways and such huge volumes of scientific research out there and very specialized needs that people have, there's a need for better tools for identifying, locating that knowledge on the web, and then beginning to organize and sift through it for useful purposes. So one test project that Science Commons launched, it was called the NeuroCommons Project. And it's an attempt to use semantic web metadata to help web users identify, organize, and use research. It puts so-called URI, Universal Resource Identifiers, tags on articles or databases or clinical images or videos, so that if you want a very specialized type of information that's tagged with that name, you can grab all of that exists on the web and sift through it intelligently to locate very specialized knowledge. It's a pioneering attempt to use metadata to make science more efficient and effective in making discoveries and developing new innovations. Science Commons has another very significant project, the so-called CC0 project, which is an attempt to make databases and the data on them more shareable. Part of the problem with databases is that they are often technically incompatible, or it's not clear who owns what aspect of it, because facts can't be copyrighted, and so normally to assert a copyright in database information might be problematic. You might be able to copyright the organization of the facts, but not the facts themselves. So for a long time, Science Commons and many other people thought that maybe you should devise a copyright-based license for data as a way to make it shareable, just as they did with text and video and music. But then they came to realize that because the definition of what's copyrightable in data is so vague and contestable, there's a better strategy, and that is to devise a trademark for open data that the Science Commons and its panel would award to databases that had satisfied certain criteria and principles. So that if you had established that your work could be shared in certain specified ways, you would earn the right to put an open data trademark on your database, which would signal to others that they could use it for free under the terms specified by the CC0 trademark. So this was an attempt to contractually reinvent the public domain. People would have a contractual relationship with the Science Commons Open Data Project to use data, and it's an ingenious scheme to unlock the potential of shareable data, which otherwise was kind of a legal and technical nightmare to resolve. There's more on that in my book under the Science Commons chapter. So these are just some examples of how the Creative Commons has just exploded into different arenas over time. I'd now like to move on to another thematic section of this talk about the economics of online sharing, because this is a major topic for our time today. At first, the idea was, people thought, why would legal licenses like the Creative Commons be terribly significant? How could they possibly become the foundation for a major international free culture movement and science and education movements? Well, this is a bit of a mystery, but one of the important reasons for the huge success of the licenses is what I call the great value shift. Around 2002, 2003, the internet infrastructure was maturing and reaching a new flashpoint, a new critical mass. It was starting to facilitate novel forms of social interaction, a phenomenon that has come to be called Web 2.0. And essentially, the web was becoming social and interactive rather than static, fixed, and like print. People were developing the software tools and the network capacity, the bandwidth of access to the internet was expanding such that you could have more fluid, ongoing, interactive engagements on the web. And what this helped reveal was that the incredible efficiency of user-driven value creation on open platforms. There was the new ability of what could be called socially created value to express itself and protect itself within the commons. In other words, the commoners themselves could create, manage, curate, and protect their own content rather than having to be consumers of content made by sellers, producers, professionals. The amateur could begin to get a foothold and actually begin to compete with the marketplace. This was a revolutionary shift. Now, the core principle for protecting the commons as a vehicle for value creation is, in my terms, that which is created within the commons must stay within the commons. The challenge was to find either legal or technological or social norms to assure that the commons would be protected and that it would not be appropriated and taken private. Now, a number of companies were quick to recognize the huge potential of socially created value on open platforms, and they've been among the biggest successes. Google built its search engine algorithms around the collective choices of internet users, which made the search results far more usable to people. eBay built a reputation system that rated the trustworthiness of sellers, which made people more confident to buy through eBay. Amazon leveraged the social recommendations of customers for books and other products. And you find this on the Apple sites like iTunes, iStore, and iPhone. They had open APIs, open application protocol interfaces, so that various software developers could develop their own compatible programs to work on the platform. It was not a commons, but it is an open platform controlled by the company. But by making it open in certain respects, they could leverage the value that the company itself could reap. Now, the point is that open platforms have had a huge disruptive effect on business strategy and organizational behavior in business. Well, business as well as government and nonprofits. By using the open APIs, developers and companies aspired to create ecosystems of wealth creation around the proprietary platform. It was no longer possible to simply own everything outright the way content producers in the 20th century tried to. Now you realize that you had to have an ecosystem of complementary companies who would create value in their own way. And all of this, all of these developments were in a way changing the very definition of wealth and value. Because on the internet and on open platforms, wealth is not just financially financial wealth, and it's not even necessarily privately held wealth. It's often socially created value that's shared, evolving, and non-monetized. It sort of hovers in the air, to speak, and is available to everyone. So the great value shift has been about the changing value of exclusive property rights. It used to be that having strict exclusive property rights was the way to make money. That's not necessarily the case on the internet, because open access can prove to be more valuable than outright ownership, meaning exclusion. A friend of mine has quipped that the only thing worse than being sampled on the internet is not being sampled. And that's because value increasingly comes from being accessible and from having your name and work circulated, not from being not from having it being tightly held as exclusive, as private property. This was one reason why the New York Times discontinued its Time Select subscription service, which it was generating about $10 million a year in revenue. And the Times figured, but the Times decided to do away with the paywall and the subscription and the payments because it figured it could earn more money by and generate more traffic through advertising by having all of it open. And after all, many of its star columnists on the op-ed page, Maureen Dowd and Paul Krugman and others, if they weren't available to be quoted and linked to on the web, they were less influential, less popular. Major companies like the Times have had to create this balance between openness and closed and as a way to make money. Now, the Times is now in the process of reconsidering and is thinking of erecting some sort of subscription service paywall again. It's unclear at what terms they will impose if they do that. Certain major companies like the Wall Street Journal and Consumer Reports and the Times have been able to do that, but because their content is seen as either so authoritative and special, whereas many others are unable to force or persuade people to pay for content. So openness still is the general rule. And all of this is one reason why the music industry has suffered so much, because it was so resistant to the idea that the open circulation of content could create value, that fans needed to have the freedom to socially circulate music to create demand for the music. By insisting upon such strict, exclusive, tight proprietary control, the music industry, ironically, was undercutting the social basis of its own market. People wanted to be able to be free to determine how they listen to the music on their own terms without having the industry shoving it down their throats or monitoring how they could do it. So this is, I think, a profound lesson, the music industry's engagement with open platforms, something that's discussed in a terrific book, Appetite for Self-Destruction. Anyway, the Creative Commons licenses, with the help of the open internet and Web 2.0 software, has spawned countless online commonses. There are web archives like the Internet Archive and academic repositories. There's the Internet Movie Database, which later went commercial. There's the blogosphere, which has knitted together communities of blogs through the RSS, the syndication feeds, and blog rolls. There's all sorts of wikis, most notably Wikipedia, but also many special interest Wikipedias like Wookiepedia for Star Wars fans and Intellipedia for the U.S. government's intelligence community, and many others. There's open access journals. There are scientific database commonses. There are music remix communities. There are video mashup communities, and on and on. Many of these are formally facilitated by free software and Creative Commons licenses. Now, one of the major theorists of this universe of new economics, culture, and politics is Professor Yochai Benkler of Harvard Law School. And his 2004 book, The Wealth of Networks, is an instant classic of theoretical analysis and empirical fact of what he calls commons-based peer production. And this is, he defines that as work that is collaborative, non-proprietary, and based on sharing resources and outputs among widely distributed, loosely connected individuals who cooperate with each other. Peer production is basically individual action that's in which people self-select to participate in things, and it's decentralized rather than centralized, hierarchically assigned content production. So, for example, a company or a government bureaucracy will have their own standard hierarchical top-down approach to how you create things, whereas peer production is a bottom-up, self-selected process, which is seen most notably on Wikipedia, but in fact there are just hundreds of examples. For example, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence project, which uses the excess computing capacity of individual PCs, is an instance of distributed computing coordinated by a central project. Or you have lots of websites where people identify butterflies and birds and count, and the results are aggregated on a centralized website that helps keep track of the migration patterns or populations of birds and butterflies. There's distributed proofreading projects for books. There's the NASA Click Workers, where volunteers actually classify satellite images of Mars to determine the size and different categories of craters. So there's many, many such instances of bottom-up aggregation of information where people self-select to participate. Now, what's interesting about this new model of production is it has ridiculously low financial overhead and number of staff that are needed. Wikipedia has, I think, on the order of a dozen people on its staff. Everybody else is volunteer. The self-selection for tasks is highly efficient, and it yields a passionate commitment. You can have effective large-scale collaboration among huge numbers of people. The marginal cost for sharing information and music and imagery as a public good is zero. And you have a phenomenon that Benkler calls cooperation gains, which, you know, neoclassical economics tends to see everything through the prism of market exchange and cash and competition and individuals. But in the online world where this collaboration can occur so fluidly, you can get unsuspected cooperation gains, a kind of a surplus value that is shared by everyone. Now, to be sure, there are certain requirements for this kinds of production. One of them is the modularity of tasks. It has to be able to be broken down in certain ways. And it has to be, the other requirement is it has to be granular enough. It has to be of a size that an individual can engage with it constructively. But there are some positive benefits to doing production through social exchange instead of market exchange. Even though there are kind of ambiguities of what should be done who should do them, is that person talented and trustworthy enough, some of those ambiguities can be worked out more readily than through a transactional system like a market, which requires strict quantification and calculation of units of labor and so forth. And it turns out that the price system is often too crude of a unit of information for conveying the variable performance that human beings have. And in other words, it can be done more sensitively and flexibly, more versatilely through a social community than through a more formalistic, legally negotiated transaction, which has to specify the terms of a labor project and so forth. So some fascinating, at the very basic human, almost ontological level, there's some fascinating shifts in how value gets created. And the other thing that social communities do in the production process is they can assign relevance and accredit trustworthiness and truth to certain things that perhaps the market won't or can't do. So, for example, on Amazon, you have, it's the popular feature of customers who bought items you recently viewed also bought these items. So it's a way of the social community to register their preferences, which are often quite valuable. Netflix, the DVD rental site, does this, where friends and favorites recommend these films. This is very similar to the computer hacker site Slashdot, which assigns so-called karma points to certain commentators and responders to blog posts. People who are seen as highly respected by the community get higher karma points and can help raise to greater prominence certain content on the site because of who they are. It's all similar to the Google PageRank algorithm for searches, which helps identify the more popular searches and therefore identifies the more useful, what the community regards as more useful information. So you have social communities being a more powerful, influential force in the production process. And just as free and open source software mobilized human energies and commitments in ways that the market could not, so commons-based peer production leverages the informal social relationships of people in the unregimented free spaces of open platforms. Benkler points out that behaviors that were once on the periphery, social motivations, cooperation, friendship, decency, move to the very core of economic life, unquote. And money and markets don't necessarily control the circulation of creativity anymore. Increasingly, the social community does through various types of social understandings or actual software protocols. So you have these very fascinating shifts where human capacity and judgment and talent becomes the primary scarce resource in the networked information economy, as Benkler points out. And you see the reemergence of decentralized relationship-based markets. And you see copyleft strategies like the GPL and the Creative Commons licenses trying to formalize reciprocity. And you have lower capital costs, which makes it easier to have non-proprietary strategies for appropriating and using content. So what this all leads to is that open platforms in the network environment become a new sort of business proposition, a different matrix, a different framework for new types of businesses, businesses that will operate in a very different way than traditional, hierarchical, centralized businesses that require strict exclusive property rights. But a business on open platforms has a number of advantages. It can more easily cut its costs because the capital expenses are lower. it can enhance innovation by using the social community to its benefit. It can enable faster and more versatile responses to the shifting demand of the market. And consumer demand itself can be self-organized and expressed more accurately and passionately than through the top-down marketing categories. Music has all sorts of genres of music, you know, country, metal, rock and roll, and so forth. Well, in the bottom-up scheme of things, some of those categories are top-down impositions that don't reflect people's actual consumer tastes and preferences. And this is part and parcel with word of mouth becoming a more powerful engine of marketing than top-down advertising. So as you can see, the social community is more empowered as a real driver of markets, one might add, in the way that Adam Smith intended in his original theoretical constructs, but in ways that contemporary economics has really failed to recognize because it has become so seller-dominated in its perspective. And then finally, in the open platform, unlike the mass media, which loves lowest common denominator types of content and style because it can amass the biggest market, on open platforms, niche specialties can flourish. You can have the rise of the so-called long tail, where very, very small niches of consumer demand can actually be economically viable. It's been said that over half of the revenue that Amazon generates comes from books that are rated at 130,000 or less. And that's because there's so much demand from those lower ranked books that they still generate a huge amount of income. So the long tail becomes a viable proposition on open platforms. Benkler points out another profound change in this new environment, and that is that the traditional boundaries of the firm become more porous in the networked environment. He wrote a famous essay called Coase's Penguin, in which he explained that it's sort of a insider pun, but Coase was a famous economist who wrote an influential essay about the theory of the firm and why firms get created. And essentially, when a firm can do things cheaper internally through lower transaction costs within the firm than going on the market, a firm gets created. So it's easier, for example, to hire people and to develop internal systems and bureaucracy within a firm rather than to contract for everything on the market. And that's why a firm has existed historically, said Coase. But with the rise of Linux, as an example, whose mascot is the penguin of Coase's Penguin, a different framework takes place where social production can occur outside of the firm and do things more efficiently than a firm. It can compete with the firm. The penguin can compete with the firm, and you don't necessarily need a corporation to produce valuable things. This has been epitomized in a famous essay, The Cathedral and the Bazaar, written by Eric Raymond, where the cathedral is a corporate operation that tries to amass all the talent within one place and develop canonical systems all internally, versus the bazaar, the BAZAAR, where you have a babel of diverse voices and participants who, working on open platforms, can create value more competitively in many instances than the cathedral, where all the work is proprietary. This dynamic was most vividly shown in IBM's embrace of open source software as a competitive business strategy in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Nowadays, IBM actually makes more money from Linux-related services and tech support than from its own enormous patent pool. The company actually brilliantly saw the long-term advantage of building a competitive business model around open-source software, because they saw that it would give superior performance to its clients than proprietary software, yet it could still make money by providing service and support to software that would evolve, and that customers would rather have an open, a reliable open source software program than one that would lock them into a vendor that might then abuse them, the way that IBM itself had done in decades past. So we begin to see the rise of open business models, which I deal with in chapter 10 of my book, Viral Spiral. Open business models take advantage of the vulnerabilities of centralized media business models, which have high overhead costs, centralized management, which is less responsive and more expensive, huge branding and marketing costs, huge lawyering and contract enforcement costs, huge recruitment of talent costs in order to build, create blockbusters and build and maintain stars, and then huge legal and technological costs in fighting piracy. So open business models can shed all of those enormous costs and work far more efficiently to leverage what I called earlier the great value shift, the user-driven, socially created value. There's now a huge amount of experimentation in open business models, and the topic is really insufficiently theorized about what works and what doesn't and why. I don't have time to go into it at great length. Suffice it to say, there are differences between businesses that are based on open platforms, such as Facebook or YouTube or MySpace, where they leverage user-generated content to make money for themselves. They privatize the community's content or private information through advertising or data mining for marketing purposes, versus the commons or commons-based business models where the users own and manage the resources. Examples of this are like free software, the Internet Archive, Wikipedia, Craigslist. Now, some of those are maybe not strictly commons-based in the sense that there might be a benevolent despot who runs it, like Craig Newmark of Craigslist. But the point is, they're not either public companies or they're not being run to maximize revenue or for the benefit of investors. They're being run either in trust for the commoners or they formally are owned and managed by the commoners. So there's an overlap between open platform-based businesses and commons-based businesses. They share a lot of similarities, but in terms of ultimate control, there also are some significant differences. Without going further into open business models, I will just refer you to chapter 10 of my book. I would note a notable professor, MIT's Eric von Hippel, who has done a number of fascinating studies of how communities can collaborate with companies to create innovative new products. And the idea is that on open platforms, producers and consumers are, the boundaries between them are starting to blur, and producers can get more close to consumers and communities, online communities, and ascertain what they want, what interests them, and use that information to create more responsive products, and therefore merge in a way with consumers. Some people have created the neologism prosumer to reflect this blurring of consumers and producers. In any case, von Hippel has examined a number of different communities of enthusiasts who have been the basis of new product innovation. So, for example, there are all sorts of extreme sports fans, extreme skiing, extreme sail guiding, extreme bicycling, rock climbing, and so forth. And it turns out that the biggest enthusiasts in these kinds of sports are often developing their own makeshift equipment innovations and talking about it with each other. They don't have the means to mass produce it or bring it to market. And that's where the sports companies are only too eager to collaborate respectfully with those communities to take the cutting-edge innovations that the community itself develops and then market it. And you get all sorts of unexpected products. There's some of them are maybe not strict businesses. Some are maybe more veer into the commons-based. But, for example, the Open Prosthetics Project invites people, users, often people who've had limbs amputated, to suggest innovative types of limbs, prosthetic limbs that could be made. So, for example, there are limbs for rock climbers and people who fish, that have been developed, which would not likely have occurred to your typical company, or the company would regard it as such a niche product that it really couldn't make enough money. So the point is that a community of customers can act as a cheap and reliable source of R&D and product development. And this might be open the door to the exploitation of those communities, which would be troubling. On the other hand, there can be respectful, symbiotic, and productive relationships between producing companies and communities of enthusiasts. So these are some of the bigger trends that have emerged. Now, as you can see, I've covered a long arc of development from copyright to the economics of open sharing. This is a rich and burgeoning topic these days, but for at least a primer on it, I recommend reading the chapters of Viral Spiral, and one can also consult the Peer-to-Peer Foundation's blog, which has extensive materials on its website about it. And with that, I'll conclude my lecture week 10, and we will resume next week with next week we'll discuss the academia as a commons in week 11.